Hello, everybody, and welcome to Danger on Delmarva. My name is Rhonda Jefferson, and I'll be your host as we explore the dark and winding paths of the Delmarva Peninsula. If you're new here, welcome, and if you're a returning listener, welcome back. Delmarva is a region that's in the Mid-Atlantic area of the United States and encompasses all of Delaware, even though some dispute exactly how much of Delaware, Maryland to the east of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and Virginia to the north of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. By the time I was done with the research and notes for this episode, I ended up with 32 pages, and that is by far the longest one I've ever written. And I thought last week's was long, but this is definitely taking the cake. So I'm going to kind of shorten the intro to just a few things that I think are most important, but I just don't want to end up with a 3-hour episode. So I'm just going to kind of rush through these. One is, as usual, the links to my sources will all be in the description of the episode. Most of the sources will say they come from The Countryside Transformed, and that's a site where the University of Virginia has archived, digitized different newspapers. So you'll see a name of a newspaper and then via The Countryside Transformed. Even though those articles are also available on newspapers.com, which I do use quite frequently, the one through University of Virginia is free, so I definitely wanted to put those in there. There are a few other sources, though, that did come from different places other than the University of Virginia, but they are the primary source, and it was extremely helpful. Also, there is still difficulty finding the podcast through YouTube Music. There's some difficulty sharing also the link, as when I click the share function, it's not available. And when reaching out to support, they said there's still not that functionality yet to have podcasts that were shared in a certain way, to have that link there where I can just share it and either, you know, copy the link or send it directly to someone. So hopefully all the bugs will be worked out soon. I see a lot of Reddit threads where people are having difficulty. So what I'm going to do is, you know, have all of my contact information in there in the description or, you know, the notes of the podcast. And if you go to my regular YouTube page, there should be options to be able to view the episode via like a static image, you know, one that's the same throughout the whole episode. And it's uploading both at the moment. So if you do see two links, if you're listening through YouTube Music, one is made to be a video and one is made to be a podcast. I hope to streamline that in the future, either that or start actively working more on doing videos that have different scenes to it. I thought about it with this one, but it's going to be quite long and I didn't want, you know, my first effort to be one that, you know, was that daunting to discourage me. So it'll probably be a shorter episode that I go ahead and try to work on the other videos for. Also, we have hit 6,000 downloads. It's probably a little more than that, but I can't see YouTube Music's numbers for the most recent episode, but I'm very grateful, you know, that we're hitting that milestone. I wasn't really sure if I would be doing this for as long, you know, as I am, just in the fact that I wasn't even sure if I could do it technologically, since I don't really have, you know, much training in audio or anything like that. And while sometimes when things go wrong technologically, it's more than a little frustrating, it's also, you know, nice to learn about the history of the region I live in, even though unfortunately there are some negative things that impacted the region at different times. It does reflect the events that shaped the Delmarva Peninsula. If you would like to support the podcast in any way, to support the hosting service or cost for research, there will be links to PayPal and Buy Me a Coffee in the description. And finally, as most of my episodes deal with tragedies, that have happened on the Eastern Shore with those few episodes that are, you know, that I do every once in a while that are a little more lighthearted, but most will include discussions that some may find hard to listen to, whether it be about violence or death, tragedies, you know, again, that have hit the Delmarva Peninsula. And in today's episode, we are going back to 1884. And this is the second episode about the Pitts brothers. The first episode was about Major Sidney Pitts. And if you haven't listened to that one yet, you can still listen to this one. There will still be some references back to the case, but it's not, you know, 100% that you have to listen to the first one to, you know, listen to the second one and still understand it. But both cases really put me in awe of how quickly things can escalate in certain instances. So you'll hear about that in a few moments. So I'm coming back in to add a couple of things I needed to add. One is I realized I did not mention that I realize that this case will not be an actual duel on Delmarva, but I did like the alliteration of, you know, the duel and Delmarva. Also, as I've continued to record and I had gotten close to around 55 minutes of the recording before editing, I've realized, you know, even though editing shortened it a little bit, I'm still going to need a third episode, so I apologize. I just wanted to come back in and add it to the beginning, since I was trying to do it all in one episode when I first started recording. But I did want to take a little bit of a look at the history of the area, which is Tangier Island. That's where the main event takes place today, I guess you would say, or the crime took place, even though eventually the trial itself was sent over to mainland Virginia, just because it was pretty infamous on the Eastern Shore at the time. And even though it was widely reported on, even nationally, it was thought that there would be a better trial in another county. I will also talk a little bit more about the patriarch of the family, Edward Parker Pitts, who was a judge. And it's amazing how a revered judge and also their uncle, maternal uncle, was a senator for Maryland, Senator Dennis, how you will sometimes hear people say, oh, they came from a good family. What does that really mean? And we can see how differently people turn out, even when, you know, they grow up in the same family. So maybe a matter of nature versus nurture. And sometimes one outweighs the other. So first, let's take a look at the location of Tangier Island. Tangier Island has many trails that inhabit the area, including the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail. That is a very long name. The Star Spangled Banner National Historic Trail, and a lot of other features that allow people to get back to nature and a place that also has a lot of history to not only the area, but to the nation itself. As of the most recent 2020 census, there were about 436 people who were residents of the island. Unfortunately, though, since 1850, so going back a little less than 175 years, the actual mass of the island has shrunk by 67%. As with so many places on Delmarva, we are at sea level with very little elevation in most areas. You know, so even where I live, we get flooding quite often, even though I'm inland. Just, you know, the topography is, you know, really close to sea level, and that doesn't allow for there to be a lot of rain and not have at least some flooding in some areas. People even joke that sometimes that we have a new swimming pool in the backyard or there's a new river and they're talking about water running through the roads. And again, I live inland in Western Sussex County, so we're not right at the bay. We're not right at the ocean, yet we still get flooded. So imagine an island itself, one that is losing its landmass. And I did find, when searching for my podcast, unsuccessfully on YouTube Music, one that is about the shrinking of Tangier Island or other islands in the area. So if I can find that again, I'll link that in case you're interested. But it is estimated, based on the past shrinkage, for lack of a better term, that if things continue as they are, most likely the island will need to be abandoned within the next 50 years. This is per research that was published in 2015 from a report titled Climate Change and the Evolution and Fate of the Tangier Islands of Chesapeake Bay. Now, the island is remote enough so that it's even recognized by linguists as having its own dialect. This is attributed to the fact that it is more difficult to get to the mainland than, say, necessarily other areas. The first information that we know about the history of Tangier Island predates the European settlement in the North American continent. John Smith, who, just for the record, his character, the story, is not the same as the John Smith that you do see in the Disney movie of Pocahontas. Even though technically it's loosely based on him, when I first saw the movie, I was really confused because I was like, this is not what I remember from history class, but they did take creative license. But the island was spotted by John Smith in 1608, and at least at that time that he was on the island, he considered it uninhabited. He named the series of islands the Russell Isles, though what Smith actually meant by this has been disputed as to whether it was just the individual island or if it was the string of islands that were close to Tangier that Smith was referring to, such as Watts Island. So it's considered rather ambiguous. It can also be a little confusing as that while it's called Tangier Island, there are marshes around three distinct land ridges. In what's called the main ridge, that offers most of the town's services, such as restaurants, etc. However, with the increased amounts of flooding, especially when hurricanes or tropical storms hit the area, two of these ridges are almost or expected to be gone soon. The town itself has been featured on national news, with one incident being in 2017 when CNN profiled the town and its efforts to raise money to try to form some type of barrier or protection for the island. Then President Trump did reach out to the mayor who had been featured in that CNN episode and was promised assistance, but there was not an actual amount provided as to what that assistance would be or even when that might be coming. But so far, at least on the reports I read, there were no updates as to any of that assistance. Going back to when Smith spotted the island, he may have considered it uninhabited, but it is thought that the native population may have been on the island at some point, as artifacts and fishing equipment have been found there. It may have just been that at different times of the year, because of the difficulty in getting to the island, that it may not have been inhabited, but may have been used for fishing or other activities at different times during the year when it was easier to access. And in something I didn't know was possible, somebody received a patent for the island in 1670. That man's name was Ambrose White, but he didn't keep the island for very long. He sold it to two men who were going to use the island to graze their livestock. The first person who permanently settled on the island was sometime in the 18th century, and his last name was Crockett, and that last name is still seen quite frequently on the island. Some of the earliest recorded use of Tangier Island, besides livestock grazing, was actually for the War of 1812. It was used by the British where they built Fort Albion. It could hold 1,200 British soldiers. Also, while looking at the state of Virginia as being the heart of the Confederacy, not every part of Virginia felt that way. They did not want to secede from the rest of the United States, and they also did not support slavery. And this will actually impact the Pitts family, and I'll explain that a little more when we get there. But many runaway slaves were able to reach Fort Albion on Tangier Island and were given sanctuary by the British. Many of the escaped slaves joined the Corps of Colonial Marines, and this was a band of British soldiers made up at two different points in history. One was from 1808 to 1810 during the Napoleonic Wars, and again at this point during the War of 1812. During the Napoleonic Wars, many of those that were in the Corps of Colonial Marines would have served in the Caribbean. Though still a distance away, Tangier Island was close enough to Washington, D.C., and the ports of Baltimore and surrounding areas for the British to have somewhat quick access to the capital. It was used as the base for historic battles, including the battle at Bladensburg, and also during the burning of Washington in 1814. The battle proved to change the landscape of both the city and of the American government with the burning of the presidential mansion, the Capitol building, and the Navy Yard. This would give way to other architecture that we now see in Washington, D.C., predominantly the White House itself, as before there had been the presidential mansion. But this gave way to other battles, which included one that would go on to shape America even further, as the battles that took place in Baltimore and near Fort McHenry were also based out of Tangier, at least the British using it as a base. This one battle near Fort McHenry inspired Francis Scott Key to pen his poem that we now call the Star-Spangled Banner or the American National Anthem. It was originally meant to be a poem, but it was set to music and became our national anthem. Now, there's really a lot more history that's involved in Tangier, and I could go on probably for 10 episodes. And I mean, if someone wanted me to do that, I would, but I want to try to focus a little bit more on what impacts the case. But Tangier really does harken back to a village, you know, when you think of a village. Not only on Tangier Island, but some of the other islands that I visited. You know, you may find in many instances that family members, you know, they're buried on the property of their family. So there's no church graveyard. There's that familial connection always of knowing that your ancestors are buried close by. You know, there are cemeteries and churches that may inhabit the island, but you know, it's not unusual to see that on some of the islands in general. So the island's roots do run deep. And while at the most recent census, the population was less than 500, during the 1900 census, it was at 1,064. Now, understanding a little bit about all the barrier islands or islands that are bayside, I think it's important for us to remember, especially back during this case in the 1880s, that it was not easy transportation to go from one place to the other. And especially at times of medical emergencies, that's where I always had a concern with one of my siblings living on an island that, you know, during heavy rain or even just the distance away to get to a hospital if there was a medical need. But there are systems in place to transport people as quickly as possible if needed for medical intervention. Looking now at the Pitts family directly, I have mentioned their father, both Major Sidney Pitts's father and James Pitts, who we'll be looking at today. He was a judge. And when I first tried to find some more information about him, the first things that came up were short articles or notices in the newspapers that Judge Pitts was under review to be impeached to remove him from office. Now, when I first saw this, I was wondering what he could have done that was so serious that they were looking to impeach him. I'm going to read the notice directly to you, and it gives us an understanding of just how quickly things can change, where even though what I'm going to read in a moment was passed in 1862, 20 years later, in articles about these two incidents, his name is venerated. He's seen as a good man. So again, let's get to what the notice reads. This is how the notice read. Quote, the following order from the Virginia legislature passed February 21st, 1862, whereas E.P. Pitts, judge of the Fifth Circuit of the state of Virginia, has been charged before this House with disloyalty against the state of Virginia and against the Confederate States of America, and adhering to and giving aid and comfort and counsel the enemies of said state and of the Confederate States. And it is proper for the General Assembly to take such charges into consideration, and if sustained by sufficient evidence, to remove said E.P. Pitts from his office aforesaid. Therefore, be it resolved with the concurrence of the Senate that on the 25th day of March, 1862, both houses of the General Assembly will proceed to consider and decide upon via aforesaid charges against said E.P. Pitts, judge as aforesaid, and if such charges be sustained, to remove him from his said office. Resolved further that notice being given to said E.P. Pitts, judge, as aforesaid of the proceedings proposed to be had against him, and of the causes alleged for his removal by a publication of this preamble and resolutions, end quote. So I really couldn't find anything that concluded what happened in the impeachment. However, I did see future references to E.P. Pitts, and Judge was always there with his name, whether, you know, it was used as his title or as a description when given about him. So it sounds like he was able to stay a judge. And also, just as importantly, it shows that he did not hold the allegiance to the Confederate States. And that's why he was being impeached. So with the feeling amongst the island as well, it sounds like E.P. Pitts was going against, you know, the Virginia Assembly in trying to secede from the United States. Even more interestingly, though, I found some letters, and they're very short letters and correspondence, but they've all been archived in many different places, actually, but I used the University of Michigan. And the first letter is dated February 24th, 1864, and it's from a Reverdy E. Johnson. He was writing to someone we all know named Abraham Lincoln. And Mr. Johnson said, quote, I take pleasure in introducing you to Judge E.P. Pitts of Virginia, who desires to see you on official business that he will explain. As a loyal gentleman, he is most deserving of your regard, end quote. This was determined as per an annotation from another letter that referred to Judge Pitts of Northampton County, Virginia, which is on the Eastern Shore. There was a note that in 1861, Pitts had actually taken a vow of loyalty to the South, but this predates his impeachment proceedings that began in 1862. So without having all of the background, it seems to me that he may have taken that vow, hoping to be able to stay in office and be able to effect change. Now, subsequent to the letter by Mr. Johnson to Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln wrote back to a man named Benjamin F. Butler, who was a general, and he wrote, quote, Major General Butler, please see and hear Judge Pitts of Eastern Shore of Virginia. He wishes to do right, but meets some difficulty at a point which it is probable you can obviate, end quote. So even, you know, after he went through the impeachment, at least the process, even though he wasn't removed from office, it doesn't seem, And that's, again, my speculation based on not finding anything saying he was removed. But even after going through that, he is still, you know, not loyal to the Confederate States. He is still trying to communicate with the North, with the Union. So now that we know a little bit more about the background of the Pitts family, we're now going to take a look at Dr. James Pitts, which, looking through anything from old newspaper articles and other information, there's sometimes discrepancies in names. I did see a couple places where he was referred to as John Pitts, but most everything that I read said James. So that's what I believe it is. I can't tell you why in some places it said John, but we're going to go with James Pitts. Now, the news hit the Eastern Shore, as well as the, you know, rest of Virginia, and even in some ways the nation, in a way that I've commonly seen in some newspapers of the time. The article was almost written or had a feel as if it was a letter, like it was coming from a family member who lived in a different part of the state, and they were trying to communicate to you what had happened. In my mind, I almost could picture, you know, a young woman sitting at her desk saying, "You won't believe what happened here recently," and giving the narrative of events. One observation I did make, too, that I made in the last episode is when looking at Dr. James Pitts, he was in his mid-20s, but was a doctor. And just like in the previous episode where the men were attorneys, they graduated at a much younger age than we would today. Now, May 17th, 1884 should have been a day of normal work, travel, and socialization for those who lived and worked on the Delmarva Peninsula. But two professional men were about to clash in a way that could not have been foreseen, except for maybe the Pitts family, because in some ways it is very similar to what had occurred years earlier with Major Sidney Pitts. Dr. Littleton Thomas Walter was said to be about 25 years old. He had graduated from medical school at Maryland University and had already started his own practice. He had not lived on the island prior to practicing medicine, but had in the prior year come to live on the island. So, you know, given that year prior, it meant that at age 24, he already had his medical practice going, where in today's age, they wouldn't have finished medical school yet. However, soon the doctor was to become a patient as he came down with malaria. He then did leave the island for another home that he had to try to fight the illness and recover, as many people did not believe that he would survive. It was only about three weeks prior to the events of this day that Dr. Walter had come back from his other home and resumed his residence on Tangier Island. It was during the time that Dr. Walter was away that Dr. James Pitts had graduated medical school and had come to establish a career on Tangier Island. When Dr. Walter did return, Dr. Pitts saw a substantial decrease in the number of patients he saw. During the time while Dr. Walter was away, there really was no other option for doctors except traveling to the mainland, which could mean making an overnight trip and would have been a lot more complicated and a longer process. And also, if you're really sick or not able to really get around, that traveling to another location could become very difficult. Now, many patients preferred going to Dr. Walter, so one can imagine that it made Dr. Pitts feel, I don't know, just some sort of way about practicing on an island where it was very clear that most patients preferred one doctor to the other. And when I say he felt some sort of way, it's because we don't know exactly what he felt, whether it was anger, defeat, worry, a number of different things he might have been feeling at the time when he realized he was going to be losing those patients. About a week prior to May 17th, Dr. Walter, who had been married for not quite a year, had taken a brief journey to Craddockville, which is also in Accomack County, to go to his wife, and then they both would return to Tangier Island. Now, they left Oneonkoc, Virginia on a Thursday on a steamer heading towards Crisfield, Maryland. And from there, they would go to Tangier Island on Friday morning. So again, it's a longer process. They lived in a boarding house on Tangier Island and were making their way there when they saw Dr. Pitts. And when they met, there didn't seem to be any animosity or ill will about anything. They spoke cordially to each other. And this is where things start looking a lot like the Major Sidney Pitts incident, in that Dr. Pitts asked if he could borrow $5 from Dr. Walter. Mrs. Walter said that this was actually not uncommon, that Dr. Pitts had borrowed money in the past, but there had never been any issues with Dr. Pitts returning the money in a prompt manner. However, one may question whether or not Walters actually knew of what Dr. Pitts might have been using some of this money for, and whether or not Pitts actually wanted to use it for this reason. We don't actually know, but I'll talk about that in a couple of moments as that becomes part of the case. On one day, it seemed that Walters and Pitts' paths were destined to cross. Dr. James Pitts also lived in a boarding home by a woman, or who was owned by a woman just known as the Widow Thomas. There was another woman who lived close by, only about 1,200 feet away from Widow Thomas, and her name was Mary Thomas. So, again, we have a lot of last names that are going to overlap. There's no indication as to whether or not they were actually related, but one would assume they were given the population of the island and also the proximity in that they were living close to each other, as many families did. Now, Mary Thomas was known as feeling ill quite often. There really was no consensus as to what was causing this, but she had been seeing Dr. Pitts while Walter was away, but since she knew that he was back, she sent for him. Walter spent about a half an hour, give or take, with her, and then left the residence. With the two homes being so close together, it did happen that Dr. Pitts saw Dr. Walter leaving Mary Thomas's home. Now, upon seeing his professional rival walking so near, James Pitts went to the door, opened it, and, to put it nicely, asked Dr. Walter to come in. Walter was in a hurry and expressed this to Dr. Pitts. And we do have to remember, he was still recovering from a serious illness, so he may have also been feeling tired. But he, originally declined coming in to speak with Dr. Pitts. But after insistence, he finally gave in and he entered the house. Now, Widow Thomas was outside of the house when Dr. Walter came into the home. Now, she didn't really think anything of it, because they did know each other. And she didn't think it could have been that long, maybe only 2 minutes, since Dr. Walter entered the home before she heard a shot. And then another. But she was outside, so she couldn't give any commentary as to what had actually happened during those two approximate minutes that the men were alone together. Now, somehow Dr. Walter did find a way to get to the door and fell out saying, quote, "I am dying," end quote. Now, this must have been quite the shock to anybody who was out and about, or even in their homes and heard the shots ring out, to see their much beloved doctor falling down and not being able to get back up, to see him lifeless in front of a home where another doctor lived. It was reported that the total amount he could make it was 10 steps after being shot, even though later I did hear 30 as being the total distance that he went after he had been shot. Dr. Pitts, on his part, came out, checked the pulse, and then he started walking off to a store called Crockett and Chambers. It was there that the island's constable, Patrick Connerton, tracked him down and arrested him. So this is how the reports originally read in the newspapers as to what had occurred that day. Those 2 minutes would determine the outcome of the trial, because there was no question of who shot Dr. Walter. Upon investigation, it was found that Dr. Walter did not have any type of weapon on him. Additionally, he still had his gloves on his hands, which would indicate that he probably didn't even get comfortable inside the home before this happened. He hadn't settled into a seat. He hadn't sat down at a table to have a cup of tea or to discuss the business that they were meant to discuss. And even if he did have a weapon such as a pistol, it would have been difficult for him to use it while having his gloves on, though not impossible. Also coming forward shortly after the events, a man named Captain John Parks said that he was able to talk to Dr. Pitts shortly after the event. And based on the description, it sounds like this conversation took place somewhere near the crime scene. But Parks had said that he had shot Dr. Walter. Pitts even said, quote, "A good deal is the matter. Wipe the blood off his face. He is not fit for his wife to see in that condition," end quote. So he was cognizant that it would be troubling, you know, for his loved ones to see him like that, but recognizing too that he was there in the open and that everybody could see what had just happened. Now, this is the same Captain John Parks that would later ferry the body of Dr. Walter along with his young widow and friends to the mainland. The widow Walter could be heard crying even as the boat moved her late husband's remains from one part of the state to another, going across the water where the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel now allows people to drive across the wide expanse of water. What made this even more difficult for the family after having weathered Dr. Walter going through a severe illness when they didn't think that he was going to make it, he had also recently lost a brother. One of his brothers had passed away. So in a very short period of time, Dr. Walter's family was beset by another tragedy. The autopsy also showed just the ferocity of the attack. Now, one may not see it as fierce as, you know, it was not as violent as we may have seen in the past, but there was no reason for, in my opinion, any of this to have happened. The listed injuries from the postmortem showed that one musket ball entered the left shoulder and passed diagonally out to the right. Another shot went through his left arm and passed very close to a main artery. The third passed through a portion of his heart, the lower portion. And the last shot was found to have actually been through his back. And that went through the upper part of his heart. So he was actually shot in the back for at least one shot. Now, given the fact that two shots had been to the heart, I find it amazing that he was able to walk even 10 feet. So the shots were listed in this order, and I don't know if the doctor would have been trying to list them in the order that they were received, but this is just my thought based on the injuries. I think the first shot was probably the one that went through the bottom portion of the heart. This didn't say that it was at any type of angle, which is why I'm thinking it was more face-to-face. Also, unfortunately, if someone's trying to kill someone, they would be looking at the place that's most likely to bring about that person's death, so either the heart or the head. But I think he started to then turn. One shot went through the left shoulder. Then, in another instant, as he was still turning, his shoulder then became directly into the path of the shot, but more sideways, where it would go through one shoulder and out the other. In some ways, I wonder if it was almost like a magic bullet where it could have exited and then re-entered, but there was no mention of that. And then lastly, I think the last shot came to his back, as obviously at that point he had turned all the way around and was trying to get out of the house. Now, again, this is just my opinion. I'm sure forensic scientists could figure out things in more detail if they had the full autopsy, but that was just my first thought in the description of the bullet going through the left shoulder and exiting the right. So like I said, it was obvious who shot him. And even though there was an inquest, and it was found that death was caused by, quote, death from pistol shot wounds, end quote. The same man who had arrested Dr. Pitts, Constable Connerton, took Pitts to a Nancock, Virginia, which is in Accomack County on the Eastern Shore, and Pitts was put into the county jail. He was described as being, quote, perfectly cool and collected, end quote. He even did what seemed like invoices or bills from his jail cell to be sent back to Tangier Island to collect payment. But I guess, you know, to some, this may be a little crass, to say the least. But at the same time, I wonder if he really needed those funds to, you know, fund his defense. Well, then again, he does have a lot of lawyers in the family. Now, Pitts had given a statement that this was done in self-defense. He said that he needed to talk to Dr. Walter about setting some type of fee schedule. You know, the medical profession is not like it is now with, you know, billing being all about insurance. You know, the doctors themselves would set their fees. You know, doctors, I'm sure, were able to work around some things if patients weren't able to pay. But they had wanted to talk about setting forth some type of standardized schedule so that it wouldn't seem like they were trying to take each other's clients by charging too little. And that will come up again in a few moments. But somehow this conversation and situation devolved to the point where Dr. Pitts felt it was, according to him, necessary to shoot Dr. Walter in self-defense. What really seemed to kind of spur this situation on was supposedly Dr. Walter called Dr. Pitts a damn liar, and that Dr. Walter struck Dr. Pitts. According to Pitts, it was after he was struck that he shot Dr. Walter. Widow Thomas stood outside as Pitts approached Walter's body and leaned down to take a pulse. According to Widow Thomas, that after she took the pulse, or after Pitts took the pulse, she then said that he told her that, quote, if he had not been dead, that he would have finished Dr. Walter off, end quote. What was going through James Pitts's mind at this point? We probably will never know. Now here, I automatically think, was the $5 the motivation? My mind goes back to Major Sidney Pitts's case with money being borrowed and the subsequent events after that. I won't say too much if you haven't listened to it yet, but was it really the $5? There's also professional jealousy, losing patience, all of those things I've mentioned before. Could those have been really the motivating factor? Because while $5 may have been a lot then, it would not help out in the long term that much. But soon after Dr. Walter's death, people who were not really as familiar with Dr. Pitts were about to find out information about him that may actually help us understand what he may have been thinking or why he may have been thinking in a certain manner. We find out that Dr. Pitts himself had recently spent time in a hospital in Baltimore. Now, initially, it was said that he spent about a month, but a little later, we'll hear some testimony that disputes that. But he was in the hospital for his addiction to morphine and whiskey, is how it was termed in the articles of the time. So he was known to use morphine, use whiskey excessively, and so he had left Tangier Island about 6 weeks prior to these events to go to the hospital. According to the Baltimore Sun, quote, it is thought by some that his mind was affected by the use of drugs and stimulants, and that his killing may have been done in a moment of frenzy, resulting from the effect of professional jealousy on a disordered brain. The parties to the tragedy are each about 25 years of age, end quote. Now, I was trying to get everything into one episode, but since I'm at 55 minutes now, before I go in and edit. I'm thinking that a second episode will probably need to be done, because otherwise this one's going to end up being 2 hours. I kind of went down a rabbit hole with this episode because I kept finding out different information, such as we'll hear some conflicting information in the next episode. So that's why I do want to go over details from the court case. So that's what we'll be going over in the next episode. I think it's important to go over those because I see it a lot of times, not as much in today's newspapers, but reviewing past ones where things are really quoted as fact or sound like they're fact and they're not, which is probably why we have terminology used in journalism today, such as assumed, alleged, things like that. Whereas these newspapers seem to be stating them as fact. And when we get to the testimony in court, we'll see that not all of that matches up. So I do hope you found the history of the area interesting. I have been working on these episodes for quite a while, this one and the previous one. And yeah, I was typing up things the week before the incident with the Key Bridge, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And so I'd already mentioned, in my typing, Francis Scott Key, and then to hear his name in that manner, that the bridge had fallen, that was named after him, it was really kind of eerie. And how quickly images of the bridge falling, that we could see online almost immediately. Just a side note, too, is interestingly, some of the Eastern Shore, and it's really the northern part of the Eastern Shore, got a little bit of an earthquake recently. It was on April 5th, and the results I found when looking for information about earthquakes in or near Delaware and Maryland, because it was north of Delaware, so I thought it would probably be too far north to be felt in Virginia. But there's really not a lot of information, even though there have been some substantial earthquakes in Delaware, but long before what I think most of us can remember. Even though the one in New Jersey was 4.8, it was concluded that people did feel it in many states of the Eastern Seaboard, including Delaware and Maryland. But then on another site, it said that there have been no earthquakes near Delaware that have exceeded 3.0, yet New Jersey was 4.8. And even though it was in the northern part of New Jersey, I think the fact that it could be felt in Delaware should be included there. But I recall 4 earthquakes, even though I did not feel 3 of them at all, even though supposedly I should have been able to. And then the 4th one I did feel, but I lived maybe about a quarter mile from depending on what part of the track it was, but I lived near a railroad track. And sometimes there would be rumbling with, the trains going by. And I just thought, wow, that was a really heavy train, to be making that much noise and vibration that the house shook. Only a little bit later when things started floating across Facebook and Twitter, now X, did I realize that it had actually been an earthquake. And according to some of the articles I've read, that's what some people thought it was, like heavy traffic, like machinery being moved, things like that. But, we do get tornadoes sometimes, we get really bad weather. So fortunately, at least in recent memory, there haven't been any severe earthquakes on Delmarva, and hopefully it will remain that way. But I will get the next episode up as quickly as possible. I'll start recording that right now and make sure the title for the next one shows that it's part 3 of Duels on Delmarva, not, part 2, so that they'll at least be something to differentiate the 2 episodes. But I will talk to everybody again soon. Have a good day and good weekend if you're listening to this on Friday. Thank you. Bye.